This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the June 22nd edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phone to you, our listeners. There remains a range of opinions about who was behind the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon 15 years ago this September 11th. There should be little doubt, however, that it was America's response to that day's events that has been the driving force in producing the unprecedented destabilization, terror, and carnage that have engulfed the Middle East and Southeast Asia, producing the proliferation of jihadist groups and the flow of refugees into Europe, none of which shows any signs of abating. And yet, if you listen to our president or to our national media, you get no sense that this global catastrophe is America's doing, our contribution to the 21st century, and hence no thought of holding anyone accountable. One would say, ironically, if it had been predictable, that it was Barack Obama, elected to presidency on the basis of his opposition to the Iraq War, who put the brakes on any effort to hold the guilty parties accountable by declaring that we, as a nation, must look forward and not backward. In so doing, he was extending a pardon to one of the most vicious cast of characters to ever appear on the American political scene. And the anti-war movement, entranced by the notion of America having elected the first black president, let him get away with it. And then it vanished. Well, not everyone in the anti-war movement did so. One, Rebecca Gordon, who with her partner Jan Adams, began publishing a bilingual journal, War Times, shortly after the invasion of Iraq, has recently published a call for war crimes trials for 22 individuals who are most responsible for launching the war in Iraq. It's called America Nuremberg, the U.S. officials who should stand trial for post-9/11 war crimes. And I'll be speaking with Rebecca about it at 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned for that. When is a terrorist not a terrorist? Well, apparently for the Western media, when the killer or killers are not Muslim. Last week, Joe Cox, a member of the British Parliament from the Labour Party, was shot and stabbed to death by a man known for his connections with neo-Nazis in the UK and the United States. It was clearly a terrorist act. Yet nowhere in our mainstream media, as it was with the murders of 9 members of the Emmanuel African Methodist Church, Episcopal Church in Charleston by white supremacist Dylann Roof a year ago last Friday, did we hear or see any mention of the word terror. From the point of view of the victims, as it was a week ago Sunday in Orlando, it was an act of sheer terror, and would have been that in the latter instance even had Omar Mateen not made a last-minute attempt to link his homicidal spree to ISIS. Joe Cox's murder temporarily halted the campaigning for tomorrow's crucial vote, in which British voters will decide whether or not their country will remain in the European Union. The decision whether to stay or go has split the major parties down the middle, with the murdered Joe Cox from Labour having sided earlier with Prime Minister David Cameron in support of staying within the EU, fearing an economic blowback if the voters choose to leave. In You Can't Make This Up department, Cameron made a last-minute appeal to British Jews, telling a Jewish audience that Britain can only positively affect Europe's approach to Israel by remaining in the European Union. Speaking Monday night to a Jewish health and social services charity, Cameron asked rhetorically, "When Europe is discussing its attitude to Israel, do you want Britain, Israel's greatest friend, in there opposing boycotts, opposing the campaign for divestment and sanctions, or do you want us outside the room, powerless to affect the discussion that takes place?" End quote. His remarks were widely distributed in Britain's Jewish press. The late Joe Cox, on the other hand, was a member of the Labour Party's Friends of Palestine, a fact that U.S. papers did not see fit to publish. Whatever the result, can anyone in this country imagine Americans being given the opportunity to vote on such a critical policy decision by a president of the United States, regardless of his or her political party? No, I didn't think so. It's happening in Britain because Cameron made a promise to have this referendum when he ran for re-election. As for holding Obama to his promises, well, that's another matter. However, Britain votes is not likely to affect its membership and key role in NATO, which just conducted its largest military exercise since the end of the Cold War. As a Business Insider described it, quote, "After a stunning show of force, several NATO nations concluded Anaconda 16, an annual Polish-led multinational exercise. The purpose was to bring partner nations together to train, exercise, and integrate Polish forces into a joint multinational environment while simultaneously demonstrating NATO's defense capabilities." The exercise comprised of more than 31,000 troops hailing from 24 different nations, including the U.S., Canada, U.K., Germany, Spain, Turkey, and Ukraine. Maneuvers included air assault, airborne, air defense, and amphibious operations. This event also comes at the heels of NATO's decision to deploy 4 multinational battalions to Poland and the Baltic states to boost defense, much to Russia's chagrin, end quote, that Business Insider said. And it all began with the U.S.-sponsored coup in Ukraine 2 years ago, orchestrated by Secretary of State Clinton's former press spokesperson and President Obama's appointed Deputy Secretary of State for Europe and Asia, Victoria Nuland Kagan, wife of Project for a New American Century co-founder Robert Kagan, who had already given his endorsement to Clinton before Donald Trump had won the Republican nomination. Let me at this point say to those who may have heard this before from me, I repeat it because I think it's important and because you're not likely to read or hear it anywhere else. The present situation is being compared with the atmosphere that existed between the U.S. and heads of the NATO nations, then a much smaller alliance, during the Cold War. One of the things the two eras have in common is that fear of a Soviet invasion by the peoples of Western Europe then and of a Russian invasion today have been overblown. During the 60s and 70s, I lived in and visited Western Europe a number of times, including both sides of the Berlin Wall. I don't recall meeting a single soul who expressed either support for the USSR or fear of a Soviet invasion. At the end of the Cold War and following the Soviet Union's collapse, it turned out that the CIA had exaggerated Moscow's threat for domestic consumption in order to legitimize the reckless record spending of taxpayers' dollars on weapons to fight an enemy that presented no threat to the U.S., a fact our lawmakers knew quite well. It's the same today with regard to what we are told is the threat of Russian aggression. The Europeans aren't buying it, much to the frustration not only of the White House, but of its stable of warmongering journalists, exemplified by the New York Times' Stephen Erlinger. Quote, security concerns are as high now as they have been since the end of the Cold War, he writes. Anxieties have been heightened by Russian military offensives in Crimea and eastern Ukraine, and a bombing campaign in Syria that has demonstrated Moscow's rapidly increasing capabilities. Lately, Russia has talked about the utility of tactical nuclear weapons, end quote. Well, I'm no fan of Putin. I should note that there's been nothing that can be described as a Russian military offensive in either Crimea or eastern Ukraine, and that Putin's statements regarding the use of tactical nuclear weapons may be seen as a response to Obama's promised $1 trillion investment in upgrading Washington's own nuclear stockpile. What bothers the New York Times' Erlinger is that, quote, despite the growing threats, many European countries still resist strong measures to strengthen NATO. Many remain reluctant to increase military spending despite past pledges made, I should interject, under U.S. pressure. Some, like Italy, he writes, are cutting back. France is reverting to its traditional skepticism, he writes, toward the alliance, which it sees as an instrument of American policy and an infringement on its sovereignty, end quote. The goal of the latest NATO Secretary General, former Norwegian Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg, is to build, quote, the biggest reinforcement of collective defense since the end of the Cold War, end quote, which will require installing 4 combat battalions up to 1,000 soldiers each and NATO members on Russia's borders. He goes on, well, Britain, Germany, and the United States have agreed to lead 1 battalion each to be filled out with soldiers from other NATO allies, to preserve the idea of multinational forces, writes Stephen Erlinger, leadership of the 4th is not yet in sight as the July 8th to 9th NATO summit rapidly approaches, end quote. While Douglas Luth, the U.S. ambassador to NATO, says, quote, the U.S. is not thinking about doing 2. It is planning to station another armed 5,000-person brigade in Europe, bringing the number of brigades up to 3, and pre-positioning heavy weapons like tanks and artillery, and that, said Luke, will require, quote, large sums for capital investment to build special new warehouses and infrastructure, end quote. According to an article in the current issue of Time, of NATO's 28 members, only the U.S., Britain, Poland, Greece, and Estonia spend at least 2% of their GDP on weaponry, the alliance's baseline expectation. And in absolute terms, the U.S. spends nearly 3 times as much on weapons of war as the other 27 nations combined. Given that NATO's primary purpose is to defend Europe, not the U.S., writes Times' Ian Bremmer, It's not surprising that Americans are left to wonder why a wealthy country like Germany can't take responsibility for its own defense, end quote. That's actually a very fair question, assuming that a substantial number of Americans think about such changes, which outside of those who voted for Bernie Sanders is not at all evident. First, the German people have different spending priorities than do their American counterparts. They believe, it seems obvious, that guaranteed medical care and essentially free education are more useful objects for their tax money than $100 million jets and their equivalent in tanks and drones. Then, of course, with more independent media, they have developed a more nuanced view of the Russians than have most Americans, whose ignorance about faraway places is unsurpassed. A Pew Research Center poll, for example, reported by Stars and Stripes a year ago, when tensions between Moscow and the West were high, revealed that more than half the German public, as well as that of Italy and France, were not supporting the use of military force in response to a Russian attack on a NATO member, if such would take place. This was seen as exposing the fragility of the greatly expanded alliance's bedrock principle that an attack on one is an attack on all. This past Monday and Tuesday, the New York Times ran a two-part series that was a painful Kafkaesque reminder of the Cold War, when the U.S. Air Force had B-52 bombers loaded with nuclear weapons over the skies of Europe 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with Russia as a potential target. Quote, alarms sounded on a United States Air Force base in Spain, and officers began packing all the low-ranking troops they could grab onto buses for a secret mission, end quote. So David Phillips' article in the New York Times begins. There were cooks, grocery clerks, and even musicians from the Air Force band. It was late winter night in 1966, and a fully loaded B-52 bomber on a Cold War nuclear patrol had collided with a refueling jet high over the Spanish coast, freeing four hydrogen bombs that went tumbling toward a farming village called Palomares, a patchwork of small fields and tile-roofed white houses in an out-of-the-way corner of Spain's rugged southern coast that had changed little since Roman times. The story that followed, and which comprised two full pages inside the paper, was so gripping and so important for what it revealed about our government, the military bureaucracy, and its ultimate contempt for those who serve in our armed forces and ordinary civilians in a foreign country, that I felt for sure it would be reported on NPR or The Takeaway. Since it wasn't, I'm going to tell you a small part of it, as it was told by David Phillips in a brilliant piece of reporting. It was one of the biggest nuclear accidents in history, and the United States wanted it cleaned up quickly and quietly, wrote Phillips. But if the men getting onto buses were told anything about the Air Force's plan for them to clean up spill radioactive material, it was usually, quote, don't worry. There was no talk about radiation or pollution, plutonium or anything else, said Frank Thompson, a then 22-year-old trombone player who spent days searching contaminated fields without protective equipment or even a change of clothes. They told us it was safe, and we were dumb enough, I guess, to believe them. Thompson, 72, now has cancer in his liver, a lung, and a kidney. He pays $2,200 a month for treatment that would be free at a Veterans Affairs hospital if the Air Force recognized him as a victim of radiation. But for 50 years, the Air Force has maintained that there were no harmful radiation effects at the crash site. It says the danger of contamination was minimal, and strict safety measures ensured that all the 1,500 troops who cleaned it up were protected. Phillips notes that, quote, interviews with dozens of men like Mr. Thompson and details from never-before-published declassified documents tell a different story. Radiation near the bombs was so high it sent the military's monitoring equipment off the scales. Troops spent months shoveling toxic dust. And when tests taken during the cleanup suggested men had alarmingly high plutonium contamination, the Air Force threw out the results, calling them clearly unrealistic. In the decades since, writes Phillips, the Air Force has purposely kept radiation test results out of the men's medical files and resisted calls to retest them, even when the calls came from one of the Air Force's own studies. Many men say they are suffering with crippling effects of plutonium poisoning. Of 40 veterans who helped with the cleanup, with the New York Times identified 21 had cancer, 9 had died from it. It's impossible to connect individual cancers to a single exposure to radiation, notes Phillips. And no formal mortality study has ever been done to determine whether there is an elevated incidence of disease. The only evidence that men have to rely on are anecdotes of friends they watch wither away. Quote, John Young, dead of cancer, Dudley Easton, cancer, Fermansky, cancer, and Larry Sloan, said Larry Sloan, 76, in an interview, laboring through tremors caused by a neurological disorder. At the crash site, Sloan, a military police officer at the time, said he was given a plastic bag and told to pick up radioactive fragments with his bare hands. A couple of times they checked me with a Geiger counter and went clear off the scale, he said. But they never took my name, never followed up with me. Monitoring of the village in Spain has also been haphazard, declassified documents show. The United States, writes David Phillips, promised to pay for a public health program to monitor the long-term effects of radiation there, but for decades provided little funding. Until the 1980s, Spanish scientists often relied on broken and outdated equipment and lacked the resources to follow up on potential ramifications, including leukemia deaths in children. Today, several fenced-off areas are still contaminated, and the long-term health effect on villagers is poorly understood. Many of the Americans who cleaned up after the bombs are trying to get full health care coverage and disability compensation from the Department of Veterans Affairs, notes Phillips. But the department relies on Air Force records, and since the Air Force records say no one was harmed in Palomares, the agency rejects claims again and again. The Air Force also denies any harm was done to 500 other veterans who cleaned up a nearly identical crash in Thule, Greenland in 1968. Those veterans tried to sue the Defense Department in 1995, but the case was dismissed because federal law shields the military from negligence claims by troops. All the named plaintiffs have since died of cancer. In a statement, the Air Force Medical Service said it had recently used modern techniques to reassess the radiation risk to veterans who cleaned up after the Palomar's accident, and, quote, adverse acute health effects were neither expected nor observed, and long-term risk for increased incidence of cancer to the bone, liver, and lungs were low, end quote. The toxic aftermath of war is often vexing to untangle, writes Phillips. Damage is hard to quantify and all but impossible to connect to later problems. Recognizing this, Congress has passed laws in the past to give automatic benefits to veterans of a few specific exposures, Agent Orange in Vietnam, that came late, or the atomic test in Nevada, among others. But no such law exists for the men who cleaned up Palomares. If the men could prove they were harmed by radiation, they would have all cost for their associated medical care covered and would get a modest disability pension. But no proof from a secret mission to clean up an invisible poison decades ago has proved elusive. So each time the men apply, the Air Force says they are not harmed, and the department hands out denials. First, they denied I was even there. Then they denied there was any radiation, said Ronald Howell, 71, who recently had a brain tumor removed. I submit a claim, and they deny. I submit appeal, and they deny. Now I'm all out of appeals, he sighed, then continued, pretty soon we'll all be dead, and they will have succeeded at covering this whole thing up. That's in Monday's New York Times, it and Tuesday's article by David Phillips, which deals with what happened to the town of Palomares, can be read online. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.